ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 29th of December. I'm David Lipson in Sydney on Gadigal lands. The US President Donald Trump says he's got the makings of a deal between Ukraine and Russia as the latest round of peace talks get underway. President Trump's meeting Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida. Our ABC correspondent in Washington is Rachel Clayton. Rach, Mr. Trump is sounding optimistic, but we've heard that before, so talk us through what's different this time.
Well, we've just seen the pair meet outside Mar-a-Lago. They've shook hands. They were very cordial with one another, smiling and seeming very friendly, just like almost a year ago when we saw both the presidents meet. They both took a few questions from reporters too. Mr. Trump took the majority of the questions and was very enthusiastic, really, about this peace plan, saying that the negotiations had gone well so far and would continue today. He was asked about a deadline for the peace plan to be agreed upon and said that there was no deadline, but he did believe both Russia and Ukraine wanted to, quote, make a deal, which was very along his line of speaking. And he was also asked about security guarantees, which is a big sticking point for Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky has signaled in the past that he would not agree to any peace plan without security guarantees from the US and from Europe. Mr. Trump also told one reporter that asking about security guarantees was a stupid question, but then added that there would be security guarantees and that European countries would be involved. He spoke quite highly of European leaders. President Zelensky said very little during the brief questions that were taken outside Mar-a-Lago, but he did say that 90% of the plan was complete. So both of them were incredibly positive about this plan, but it's yet to be seen whether or not Russia is going to come to the table.
Yeah, it certainly is. So what has Russia had to say, and this is critical, about this plan?
Well, less than 24 hours ago, of course, we saw hundreds of drone strikes on Kyiv by Russia, really showing that peace is not something at the top of Russia's agenda right now. And earlier today, the Kremlin foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, said that in a statement that a call between President Putin and Trump this morning lasted over an hour. And he said that President Putin does not support a temporary ceasefire that Ukraine is calling for so that it can hold a referendum on territory. And territory really is one of the biggest sticking points in this peace plan. Russia has continued to reiterate that it wants control of the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine has said that that's something that it would not give up. But in the past few days, Mr. Zelensky has signaled that it is something that he could concede on if it's something that his people want and that would require a referendum. But in order for a referendum to take place, there needs to be a peaceful country without any fighting so that people can come out and vote. And we heard today that that was something President Putin would not support. He actually said that any sort of ceasefire that would allow a referendum would create even bigger tensions and more fighting. So the talks, these peace plan talks have been going on for roughly a year now, and it does appear that we're not really that much closer to the fighting coming to an end because of Russia's unwillingness to really come to the table on many of these key points.
Rachel Clayton there. Families of victims of the Bondi Beach terror attack are ramping up pressure on the Prime Minister to establish a royal commission into anti-Semitism and intelligence failures. 17 families have signed a joint statement claiming announcements made so far by the federal government are not nearly enough. The shooting still hangs heavy over Sydney, with a strong and heavily armed police presence planned for New Year's Eve celebrations. Alison Chow reports.
As Sydney residents and tourists firm up their New Year's Eve plans, the state's Premier Chris Minns makes a compelling argument for everyone to celebrate.
We can't let these people win. This is an opportunity to show unity and defiance in relation to these horrible attacks.
While New Year's Eve celebrations at Bondi Beach have been cancelled, other events will continue as normal, including the Sydney Harbour fireworks that's expected to attract more than 1 million spectators. Both in and out of sight will be extra police officers.
New South Wales police will be out in massive numbers, in some cases carrying firearms and weapons that you haven't seen before, but we judge is absolutely necessary to send a clear message that we will keep the public safe and do everything we can to restore confidence as Sydneysiders go about enjoying the most beautiful city on earth.
Premier Minns says that'll include long-armed guns for some police. Chris Minns says he'll also consider arming a Jewish security organisation known as the Community Security Group. It's been revealed the group had warned police in November of a heightened risk of violent anti-Semitism during the Bondi event. Premier Minns was also asked about further measures to protect the Jewish community, including the deployment of the army.
Yeah, we're going to look very closely at security programs and measures in the future. We have to do things completely differently. And there's a big challenge ahead of us to rebuild Jewish life in Sydney. So I'm not going to take anything off the table.
Any such request such as this at the moment is really quite unprecedented based on recent Australian history.
That's ANU Professor of International Law Donald Rothwell. He stresses state premiers and chief ministers don't have the power to deploy the Defence Force.
Such a request would have to go through the Commonwealth. That would then trigger a review by the Commonwealth as to whether or not such a request was warranted. There are mechanisms under the Commonwealth Defence Act which do allow for troops to be called out and placed on the streets. That under certain circumstances requires the declaration of a certain type of national emergency.
Meanwhile, calls are escalating for a Commonwealth Royal Commission. 17 families of those injured and killed in the attack have signed a statement calling for a Royal Commission into the rapid rise of anti-Semitism in Australia and the law enforcement, intelligence and policy failures that led to the Bondi Beach massacre. The Prime Minister has ordered a review into Australia's federal law enforcement and intelligence agencies in the wake of the attack, but he's so far resisted calls for a federal royal commission, saying his government would cooperate with the New South Wales government inquiry.
Alison Shaw reporting there with Isabel Masali. Well, as cricket fans turn their attention to the New Year's Ashes test in Sydney, many are still scratching their heads and grumbling about the Boxing Day test. The match ended in just 2 days due to the poor quality of the pitch at the MCG. Cricket Australia estimates millions of dollars in revenue was lost, leaving many overseas travellers disappointed after arriving in Australia for day three of the action. Kathleen O'Connor with more.
Flying in from afar with nothing to see, the two-day Melbourne cricket match destroyed the dreams of many English fans to watch their team play an Ashes test in Australia.
We were in the departure lounge at Kuala Lumpur. We saw the wickets falling and we were hoping they wouldn't be falling so fast so we would actually get a day's cricket.
Graham Evans was one fan who flew into Melbourne from the UK to watch day three of the test match.
We're obviously disappointed, but we've been around this magnificent ground, been around the museum, so we're making the most of Melbourne.
So did William Tarrant and his partner Maria.
A bucket list item to come and watch an Ashes game in Australia, and yeah, unfortunately didn't manage that part.
And we had really good tickets as well.
After a near 15-year drought, England defeated Australia by 4 wickets after just 2 days.
Fine! To the fence! England win a test match in Australia.
Many questions are now being asked about the preparation of the pitch. Australia's captain Steve Smith says the length of the grass contributed to the short match.
Potentially maybe take 2 mils off and it would have been a really nice wicket.
The Melbourne Cricket Club took responsibility for the surface. Head curator Matt Page explaining he left 10 millimetres of grass on the drop-in surface in anticipation of hot weather.
This year we've gone in with 10 mils. We knew we were going to get a lot of hot weather at the back end of the game.
But is the grass being used as an excuse? Some fans think so.
Australia lost. What did they do? Some bright bugger came up with the idea of blame the grass.
To be fair, it's not very good. The pitch wasn't great, but obviously both teams had to play on it, so can't really moan.
More than 90,000 fans were expected for the sold-out third day in Melbourne. Cricket Australia estimating the early finish will cost the organisation around $10 million in lost revenue. ABC cricket commentator Jim Maxwell says there's only ever been 3 2-day test matches in the history of the Ashes series. 2 were this year.
Test matches are expected to last at least 3, maybe 4, sometimes 5 these days, but 2 days is just a bit too quick. you won't get many people going along to watch if the cricket's like this. It really has not been up to the class, the quality overall of the cricket we come to expect from Ashes.
The International Cricket Council will deliver a rating on the pitch today.
Kathleen O'Connor there. You're listening to AM where it's 20 past seven. Any of us can acquire disability at any point, but there are often limitations to the support on offer through mainstream services. Now, a simple alternative is improving outcomes across the community. Direct mentoring from those who've overcome similar challenges is creating lasting connections and big dreams. More from National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
Okay, so what would you like to write?
Beach
boys, okay.
Bonding over Braille. 9-year-old Lily Gatehouse is helping her younger brothers Andy and Eddie learn how to read and write. Lily was born blind. Her younger siblings also have no vision. Mum Gemma Gatehouse says Lily is a role model for them both.
Her and Eddie particularly have a really beautiful relationship.
Good boy!
I teach Eddie how to read Braille and he likes to play with Braille Lego, and I also teach him how to get around places with his cane.
Lily started using a cane when she was three. Eager to be like his big sister, Eddie had one as soon as he was walking.
He learns from me, whereas I didn't have anyone to learn from.
Lily's parents worked hard to connect her with others who were blind, signing her up for camps and even reaching out to me. Growing up vision impaired, I faced so many challenges that sighted people just couldn't understand. I learnt from older mentors who were blind, and that really helped with things like handing over the right cards from my wallet and knowing what colour clothes I was wearing. So when I was asked to mentor Lily, I jumped at the chance to give back. We've chatted over the phone for the last 2 years, sharing stories about how to do makeup and sort clothes. Then recently, I travelled to her home in Tasmania to meet her in person.
Hi.
Hi.
Lily.
I'm Naz. It is so nice. Can I give you a hug?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Lily, meeting other blind people or talking to other blind people has probably been one of our most valuable tools. In those moments, Lily just gets to be blind. She gets to talk about things with people who get it.
I have a tiny bit of light, call it light perception.
Yeah, you're like me.
Until we started really bringing a lot of blind people around her, she would say things like, I don't want to be blind, and now that's the total opposite.
Lily's teacher's aide, Judy Kersley, has seen her confidence grow, and she knows she's got a bright future.
Having someone living with blindness who has faced challenges throughout life, as Lily will, as a role model and mentor, is incredibly important.
Lily wants to travel the world and one day become a paramedic.
I feel like I can do everything that sighted people can do, but just in a different way.
That's 9-year-old Lily Gatehouse, ending that report by Naz Campanella. Well, around the world, preparations for New Year's Eve are well underway. In London, clockmakers have been fine-tuning the bongs of Big Ben so that it can strike midnight perfectly on time and kickstart the city's huge fireworks display. The ABC's Europe Bureau Chief, Mazoe Ford, was given a behind-the-scenes tour.
Big Ben has been helping Londoners keep time for more than 165 years. But on one night of the year, it plays an even more important role to ring in the new year. The Palace of Westminster's three clockmakers have been busily preparing for December 31st, and I've been invited up the world-famous clock tower for a look.
Everyone is looking to this clock, to Big Ben, to strike midnight and let us know when New Year's has started. So we are here to make sure that the clock is running and to make sure that it is precisely on time. Last New Year's, in fact, we struck midnight within about 0.005 of a second, which for a 165-year-old clock is pretty good.
At just 39, Andrew Strangeway is the youngest clockmaker at Westminster. His two colleagues are in their 60s. Between them, they maintain around 300 mechanical heritage clocks, including Big Ben, which brings us to an important point. While the 11-storey clock tower is commonly known as Big Ben,
That's not correct.
This is Big Ben. This is the bell. So this, strictly speaking, is what Big Ben refers to. So we have one very large bell, 13 and a half tons. And then around the outside, we have the four quarter bells. They range between 5 tons and 1 ton, and they're what play the tune every quarter of an hour.
These bells deliver the sound of London, don't they?
Absolutely, yes. You know, you hear it in the radio, you hear it in films. One tone of Big Ben, and you know that's Big Ben. It's the heart of London.
Joining us on our tour is one of Westminster's education officers, Pink Ross. She happens to be an Australian who's lived in London for 20 years.
Being up there, being in the tower when Ben rings, it does. It just gives me goosebumps. I love it. And then we get to see it on New Year's Eve, and it brings the year to an end and it starts a new one.
Pink will see Big Ben ring in 2026 from street level, but Andrew and his clockmaker colleagues have a unique observation point right beside the famous bell.
Once the clock has struck, we can watch those fireworks, and they are just the other side of the river, and so we do get a rather good view of those.
Best view in the house.
Best view in the house, yeah.
This is Mazoe Ford in London, reporting for AM.
Well, the French actor and singer Brigitte Bardot has died, aged 91. She became an international sex symbol in the 1950s and was one of the most famous women in the world at the time. But she turned her back on the film industry to become an animal rights activist. And in later life, she was a divisive figure, accused of being homophobic and racist. Europe correspondent Elias Kluwer looks back on her life.
In the 1950s, Brigitte Bardot redefined the role of women in film, an icon of femininity and a sex symbol who was once described as the Princess of Pout and the Countess of Come Hither. Born into a wealthy family, the conservative parents of Brigitte Bardot hoped she'd become a ballerina, but she had different plans. At 16, Bardot was the most popular model in France. And it was during her days as a cover girl in Paris where she met aspiring film director Roger Vadim, and the two began a passionate love affair. Bardot became the director's muse and inspiration. In 1956, Bardot starred in Vadim's debut film, And God Created Women.
Qu'est-ce qui t'arrive?
Vous voyez pas que je m'amuse?
Alors viens, ça suffit.
Vous connaissez un pays où les gens ne pensent qu'à danser et à rire?
Je vais t'y amener.
In the movie, Bardot plays a woman who freely expresses and acts on her sexual desires. The film was banned from theatres in the United States, and many in Australia also called for its removal from cinemas. But the movie launched Bardot into the stratosphere, making her a cultural icon. By the swinging 60s, Bardot was everywhere. Her flowing blonde hair, sartorial flair, and trademark sensuality made her a leading figure in the era's counterculture. She starred in Hollywood films, and although many of them were critically panned, including her starring role alongside Sean Connery in the western Shalako.
Last night you wanted me. You want me now.
Nothing could diminish the star power of Brigitte Bardot. But she admitted to struggling with fame. Her love life was tumultuous, marked by divorces and affairs. By 1973, at the age of just 39, she turned her back on the film industry, saying, "I gave my beauty and youth to men. Now I want to give my wisdom to animals." This is her speaking about her advocacy when she visited Romania in the late 90s.
I know there are problems for the people here, but I'm Brigitte Bardot and I take care of animals.
Over the course of 5 decades, Bardot won various awards for animal activism and would often be seen at animal welfare protests across Europe. But her reputation was tainted later in life after a series of homophobic statements. She was fined 6 times for inciting racial hatred due to comments she made about Muslims in France. She also expressed criticism of the Me Too movement. She was an ardent supporter of French right-wing politician Marine Le Pen and was married to her former senior advisor. 3 months ago, she was admitted to hospital with a serious illness, and on Sunday, her foundation announced she'd died in hospital. A cultural icon that struggled under the harsh lights of fame. This is Elias Kluwer in London, reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm David Lipson.